address the question, and then there would be time for follow-up from the board on an individual question. And we'd like to target about 15 minutes or so per question. So what I'll do now is read you the four questions, and then we can jump into question number one. The first one is, please discuss your general approach to ensuring that the actual record is fully developed in all hearings. And it would be important to include how a full record is developed when students are not present, and what you would do when staff members involved in the incident are not present, so that a person's credibility, if a staff member is not present in determining the credibility of the witnesses. The second is, what do you think is working well in the current expulsion process? The third, what do you think is not working well in the current expulsion process, and how would you change this? And for those two questions, if there are anything from the board's questions that we forwarded to you that you'd like to tie into that, that would be helpful. And then finally, do you have any general opinion or concern regarding whether students are adequately represented during the expulsion hearings, basically focusing on student advocates in the hearings? So with that, we'll start with question number one. And again, that's please discuss your general approach to ensuring that the actual record is fully developed in all hearings, and including how a full record is developed when the students are not present, and what you do when a staff member involved in the incident is not present, ensuring that you're receiving the appropriate information. And would you like to start, Mr. Bellman?
I'll try. I should say that I think one of the things you're going to hear from all of us is that we never talk to each other and that we've never had any sort of an orientation. So I have no idea what others do. And so everything sort of comes out of no context. The context that I work from is the context of my own practice as an arbitrator, and I've been a hearing officer for lots of other authorities. So to get to your question, I conduct myself pursuant to other kinds of processes that I've conducted. And it's not typical of those processes for one of the parties not to appear. So that's not a common factor elsewhere. It is relatively common here, and that's why you're asking your question, I presume. What comes to mind by way of an answer is that if I feel as though there are facts in that I don't understand, if there are matters that I don't understand or facts that are missing that are critical to coming to the kinds of conclusions that are inherent in these cases, I ask questions. I either ask Mr. Hill the questions or I ask a witness the questions. Those are the only people that are in the room. So I can't pick up the phone and ask questions. I have to ask questions of the people who are present. And so I do ask those questions. But in the absence of an adversarial system, of a robust adversarial process, which is often the case, I'm left with the answers that I get from one of the parties. If I feel as though I can write a decision that is sort of sensible on its face, I don't go any deeper than that, because what would be the point of pursuing that with one of the parties without anybody else in there to cross-examine or to argue about it or whatever? I just need prima facie kinds of factors to proceed. So I guess I hope that's a useful answer.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Sanders.
I sort of agree with Mr. Bellman. My background is that, we had no orientation. You learn this particular subject matter as you go along and upon your own initiative. I've taken one or two courses outside of the department. My background is that at one time I was administrative law judge for the State Equal Rights Division, which was similar to the position we have here. subject matter dealt with employment law discrimination, all type of discrimination. And my more recent job, I was a prosecutor for the State Department of Regulation and Licensing. I presented case to administrative law judge or hearing examiner. So you have a historical problem about hearing examiner and how do they complete their record. You got two schools of thoughts. Some hearing examiner think that the examiner should get any information to help them render their decision. Some examiner feels that it's up to the parties to build a record. I take a combination of both. Generally, I let the district present their case. And if they don't present sufficient facts, that's their loss. Regarding the student and the parent, if I need factual clarification to build a record so I can render my decision, I request those clarification. Once or twice, we have called the legal counsel's office during a break in the proceedings to get an answer that we thought was pertinent to the proceedings. I generally ask the parties, another thing that I think is fundamentally sound, because these are administrative procedures, which I think is built for laypersons who don't have counsels, I allow a lot of information, testimony in without legal recourse or legal objection because they are laypersons. I let them talk, give their defense or whatever to get clarification so I can render an appropriate decision. When the student is not present, I allow the district to put on what they call a prima facie case, sufficient facts to prove more probable than not than the allegations. There's some foundation to the allegations. The district generally put on their documentation. They even put on witnesses if the kid is special ed, bring those persons to talk about the IEP and all of those type of situations, manifest determination. You put on all the documents, make sure they got the appropriate notices of hearing, etc. So procedurally, we make sure all of the technical points are met. When a student is not there, technically, there's no one contradicting the allegation. So the technical matter, once the district put on a prima facie case, they've made their case. You would like to have someone there argue appropriate discipline. When the student is not there, you look at the appropriate documents, you look at the recommendations, you look at the student's record, history, all of that. That's how I proceed.
Thank you. Ms. Daniels?
Yeah. We're all longtime hearing examiners here. I've been here since the beginning of the process when it changed. I think that would have been like 1992. So I think you're talking to people who have a lot of experience here. I, too, have a background. I'm an administrative law judge in my current position. And I have a lot of cases that in my other job, people are unrepresented as well. So I am used to the fact that you're going to have people who are unrepresented. I'm not uncomfortable with questioning witnesses to make sure that facts are come out, whether it's the districts or, because if I feel that they aren't, that I don't have a sufficient understanding of it, I want to make sure that they do. Like Mr. Sanders, I let the lay people really be able to talk about what they have and then sort out my decision as to what's credible, what's not. I make credibility determinations on what people say, if there's contradictions. So in that sense, I try to develop everything that I can that makes sense within the record. One thing that didn't come out on the issue whether the student was present or not, the district has been doing a good job of trying to get student, making sure that a student or somebody is represented if they have to by telephone. I mean, I've had cases where we've, worked for, quite a bit of time right at the beginning of the hearing to see that somebody, that the student was available to be on the phone if they are unavailable to be in there in person, that their family is there, that we've worked very hard to try to do that. We do not, I mean, I don't think the district folks are any more comfortable than we are. I know Mr. Hill isn't, when they're not present, because it doesn't really help to really understand what's going on when you don't have that. And so, you know, that is one thing that I do want to say is that I try very hard, and I really do question when they say, you know, we make sure that they've gotten all the notices, that the notices have been delivered. They try to make sure that the tracking is there, that sort of thing. So when no one is there, it's not for lack of trying. And so in that sense, then we will proceed once I know that that's in there. And I do question the district on how they've been able to get in touch. I've questioned principals because a lot of times they will work towards that. They'll call social workers. They do all sorts of things to try to do that. So I do want you to understand it isn't as if students aren't there, because the process just kind of goes forward without it. They really do work very hard to do that. But in trying to develop the record, you've just got to do whatever you can to make sure, because things do come out that may not have been able to come out, because the investigations, I think the people who are in charge at each school, it's a little bit different in each school, and how they handle it is a little bit different. So you have to sort of follow the trail, if you will, and the more you can just keep questioning and figure out what's going on, the better off you're going to be. Now, clearly, I think all of us use our experience within this as well. I mean, when you've got, 15 years experience in this, you can tend to be able to sort out through some things, you know, just by having that background of having seen a number of students before you, which also means that I talk to the students a lot as well, and will talk to them directly because I have a lot of experience, and you do see that, and you try to do that as much as you can.
Thank you. Does anyone have any follow-up questions on this specific topic? Ms. Mathiak?
I thought your last comment was interesting, and I could understand how, you know, the way that the argument is developed would be different from school to school, because this is a big system with very different people. Would it be helpful to have more consistency? Do you think that's an achievable?
I think sometimes in deciding how each school is going to have, who is going to do the investigation and how they're going to handle it, may depend on how, I know at the high school level, it somewhat depends on how they divvy up the tasks. And it might be easier if it's possible to have one supervisor so they can be consistent as to how the investigation handled, how they go through it. That might assist in sort of making sure not only that they know what they have to do in order to put a credible case together, but also to, and then they would also know and be able to direct a little bit more so they can really see what's going to end up in front of us and what isn't.
You know, I guess what I had in mind was less a common supervisor. We just recently received a document on a very different topic on parental engagement, and there was sort of a list of questions to ask yourself and to go through when you're thinking about how you're engaging. And I don't know that we have a common document, but I'm wondering if something along those lines might be helpful in getting some standard pieces into the information.
May I comment?
Please.
I don't see any significant difference between the presentation from a different school. All due to Mr. Hill, there seemed to be consistency. My understanding now, too, that it's going to be one individual from every school, but I don't see any significant difference the presentation from every school, because you got one prosecutor, so to speak.
Okay. If we were to skip to the question about what's working well, I would say Joseph Hill is working well.
Yeah.
And I think we all agree on it because it's a pleasure to work with him, and with Sherry Arsley as well. But one does have a sense that it's not a bureaucratic function, that it's a caring function when you're working with him, even though he's, in effect, a prosecutor, which is a piece of business to balance that out. I think consistency is a really key matter here, and consistency is appealing in a sort of bureaucratic way. It has something to do with how things are managed in a big organization and so on. But it's more important as a factor of justice, actually. Consistency is a feature of justice, regardless of the context in which it happens, bureaucratic or not. It's very difficult to make a case in favor that for a system being just if a system is inconsistent. So I think that if you were to find, and I'm not sure you would, but if you were to find that there was inconsistency in some material way, that you might come to the conclusion that there are something that needs a remedy in terms of making the system just.
Thank you. Okay, our next question is, what do you think is working well in the current expulsion process? And you can repeat Joseph.
Yeah,
again,
no,
if you
yeah,
like to do
right.
It.
He's still working well. I think what appeals to me about the process is the fact that it seems to me it's entirely driven by the desire to do the right thing. I think once you get down into the mechanics of it, like we were just a moment ago, then it's easy to find things that are not perfect, or even less than that. But I do think that the fact that everybody who's involved, as far as I know, is trying to do the right thing by way of the pupils and the parents and the district and, in many instances, the victims, is something that I don't want to underestimate the importance of that. And so I would say that's the feature. I think if we begin to find things that are subject to criticism, I wouldn't want those criticisms to eclipse that point. Okay, it's easier to talk about the things that are going wrong, and then it might sound like the system is a bad one, because I think there are some things that could be better, but generally speaking, I think the attitude that is pervasive in the system is the best thing about it.
Thank you.
Okay. The system seems to be working okay. I can't think of anything that's not working okay, except expansively, there's a problem. You're striving for uniformity and consistency, and I guess you're trying to put in place something to institutionalize objectivity in case Joe is not here or someone with the type of person Joe is. One problem we have, at least I have, and I think we sort of discussed it a little bit before we came up, is that we don't know the outcome of our decisions. I don't know if my decision are acceptable. Have you rejected them, or am I applying wrong law, or what? I don't know if the other examiner's decision are consistent with mine or whatever. What's not working is we don't know the outcome of our decision. I think we need to know the outcome of all decision of the other examiner to see if we are applying the law of facts correctly, incorrectly. This issue has been raised in the past. I was told that these are kids and the law keep their names, etc., confidential. But we all are under the umbrella of confidentiality and privilege. I don't see why we can't talk or find out the name of a student or the outcome of a decision that each one of these examiners respectively have. We all are under the privilege of confidentiality. One time I was told that if my decision was rejected, I would find out about it. I never found out about any, but I'm sure some of mine have been rejected. So in a nutshell, we need to find out the outcome of all decisions, at least that's my opinion, of the other examiners. We need to find out the outcome of our own personal decisions. We're in limbo. I don't know anything about my decisions. Once I write them, present them to the legal counsel, and they present them to the board, I don't know a thing. That's just one thing at this point.
I have to echo that I think that one of the things that has kept me as an examiner in doing this is that I felt that there has been an incredible evolution over the years of this process of people really trying to make it work as best as it can. I can't say enough about Joseph Hill. Joseph is great to work with. He really is looking out for the best interests of these kids, of the school, of everything, and he truly is a great person to have, and you are very lucky to have him as that. Interestingly, I've had a few cases where I've actually had done expulsions for different districts, just because of over the years I've been asked to do a few cases. Madison does a better job, in my mind, than almost any other district that I've seen, honestly, because I've seen that everyone is trying to work towards getting these kids on the right track and getting them back in, if possible. I mean, you're talking some kids that I've had some question about whether or not they really were going to, you know, when I've talked to them, sometimes I felt like I've been talking to a blank wall, you know, like or something where they are really shut down. But nobody in the district has shut them off completely. I have seen other districts that would shut them off at a much earlier stage and put them where they could not receive an education from anywhere. And that, to me, is shocking. And frankly, untenable. I would not want to be in a district. I would not want my children in a district where that was where people felt like it was okay to shut off a 14 or a 15-year-old and to not let them, you know, so where it would be very, very difficult for them to get an education. And I've never felt that way. I've never felt that about any of the principals. I've never felt that about any of the people involved in the expulsion hearings. They're always working towards, let's get this kid back on track and get them where they can be in there. So that's something that is truly working really well in this district.
Does anyone have any follow-up comments on the topic of things that are working well? Ms. Carstensen?
Just on the issue of feedback, and I know that's been an issue, and I know that at least previously Clarence Sherrod had fairly strong views about that. I can say we do on occasion reverse a decision, but it's very, very rare. We more frequently modify a decision, either as to the total length, and we have been known to extend the length of expulsion, or shorten. I mean, we've done both things. The area that we most frequently are likely to modify is the point at which students are allowed to come back under early readmission. But I do think we need to explore whether we can give you much better feedback on the cases that you're dealing with, but also it would seem to me to be useful to have some sort of sense of what everybody else is deciding in similar kinds of cases. I mean, we're saying that we need that information ourselves as we look at those things. And the question is whether we can do that and meet all of the legal, confidential kinds of issues. I will say, Cheryl, that I always appreciate your comments after your decision about, you know, you just do some extemporaneous of this. This is the way I see the case. And I do appreciate that kind of an insight, and I certainly have noted the way in which all of you in the transcript handle the families and the students to try to both make them feel relaxed enough to provide the information that they need to provide, and I appreciate that.
Okay, now on the flip side, what do you think is not working well or could work better, and how would you change this? Would you like to stand
sure.
Stand us?
I think we were just talking that one of the things that I've found over the years that when you have cases with multiple parties, multiple students involved, sometimes it can be very difficult to sort out when you've only got one case, for example, just one, and you know that others are out there being done, where all the culpability lies. And interestingly enough, it was last year, I ended up having three cases from the same incident. And it was interesting for me to be able to really see how much better I was able to sort out, and frankly, in one student's case, not be able to really understand that one student I felt was caught up in a situation that was not of his, that it was not part of the group. They had not made the case in the same way. And I got the sense that Mr. Hill also, when he had the case, you know, when he was putting them all together, sort of thought that this one might be more problematic than the others. And I was able to sort much better through everything that was going on by having more than one case, more than one of the students. It was random. I mean, that's how we pick them. And I don't know how you change that. And I realize in the legal system you have that, you know, problem as well. But when... In that issue of justice, in that issue of who is culpable, who isn't, which students, you know, because you get these incidences where there are multiple students involved, it's hard to sort out all the stories, it's hard to put it all together, and that's not, you know, even the investigators can't always, you know, figure it all out. And sometimes you can do a much better job by having more than one, by having all them together, and I don't know if there's a way to change that, but... It would make things easier, at least from my point of view.
Okay. Yes. I agree with her about the separate student involved in the same factual incidents. In my previous job, when we received several complaints against the same individual, one attorney is assigned that case. If you get similar, the same fact situation, one attorney is assigned to that case. That helped the attorney understand the factual situation better. I've solved many crimes and violations by looking at the very composite of those individual facts. One thing that I think is not working or could be done better, and I came to this conclusion when I was going through your list today, and it came out in one of my more recent cases. In my more recent case, the child was in jail, participated at the hearing telephonically. The mom wasn't present, didn't participate. Mr. Hill read the exhibits, the substance of the exhibit to the student over the phone. The student had a few objections or comments. It became clear to me that it would be to a student, a special lace person, advantage to receive copies of the exhibits prior to the hearing. I don't know if that's practical, you're talking about resources, but I don't know how you consider resources when you're looking at due process and equal protection. I think either one of these attorneys will tell you that when they are involved in a case, first thing they do want to see the files. Let me see the records. I couldn't handle a case if I get the record immediately before trial. I think the students should get the exhibits and the documents that are going to be used in advance of the hearing. I think you allow 24 hours before the hearing to get it. Most of these people working, most of the cases I have, single parents, sometimes the parents are not at the hearing, so the child has to participate individually at a disadvantage. So I think they should get the exhibits package. They have one available for them at the hearing, so you can send that out with the notice of hearing. If they read those exhibits, they may have a defense. They can see something that's not correct, not accurate, that they can respond to. That's just one thing I think should be done. I did have another point, but you can go to Mr. Bellman now.
The business of holding hearings over the telephone and the like, not comfortable to me. You're not the only ones who do that. There are other settings in which that happens. Seems to be modern life. Next thing you know, we'll be doing emailing hearings and and chat room hearings and the like, and I, you know, I'll be gone by then. But it's not comfortable to somebody trained in the orthodoxies of legal practice. And I'm actually seems like the sort of thing that maybe is the easiest, more easily addressed things I'm about to say, because it really only has to do with when the hearing is held. It's a logistical issue. I'm presuming that there are some people who might come to a hearing but can't because of other commitments that they have, and then we wind up doing it on the phone or without them. So there is that. I think the inconsistency thing, or the absence of advice to us about what we are doing and you are doing, that you're hearing from all of us, is something worthy of some emphasis. I think our decisions could be more consistent with each other. The way we conduct hearings could be more consistent with each other, and how we write our decisions could be more. Those are three separate things that we all do on our own hook. I have no idea what his decisions look like, how he conducts a hearing, or what kind of decisions, what the substance of his decisions are. It seems to me the system might be a better one if we were more, that's a theme you're hearing here. Harp on it. I would also say that there may be a discussion to be had about discretion on our part, remedial discretion. I think of these hearings often as sort of very, very simplified, very, very abbreviated criminal hearings, where what we're really looking for is whether an act occurred. Was there a burglary or not? Okay, was there a knife or not? Were there drugs or not? It has nothing to do with who it is or why they did it. Okay, it's an act that we're looking for. It's a sort of jurisprudential point that we're looking at. It's not a divorce where we're trying to improve a relationship, although, because that's not the model that you've adopted here. You've adopted a criminal model here. And when I look at the sort of menu that you provide us of offenses and remedies for those offenses, punishments, really the punitive consequences of those offenses, you've been pretty concrete and pretty specific. So it seems to me, if we find the act occurred, you've told us what pretty much what the consequence ought to be. And that seems to me to make certain kinds of inquiry on our part irrelevant. And I don't know how. Because what if we found out that the kid was tortured before he did it? The fact is he did it, okay? And it doesn't say in the menu that if you had there was some prelude to the offense, it might not be an offense. It's still an offense, just like burglary would be. Okay. So I think there's something that's a little ambiguous here or vague about the discretion that we have with regard to the remedies. And I'll just say another thing about myself. I frankly don't have a sufficient grasp of the realities of the management of the school district to know whether if I sort of turn the dials on the dates involved in a suspension or a expulsion, it works, or whether you're going to have to fix it because I've done something that's untenable, because I moved something back a week or up a week or a month. I don't know what the consequences of turning the dials are, okay? I'm not exposed to that information. So I pretty much take the recommendations that are made, and they're either acceptable or they're not. At least that's the way I feel about it. Now, let me just make one other point here, and this is the most troubling one, and I think the one I want you to think about, because I know all of this is extremely well-intended. In our hearings here, and I know this is legally okay, there is compounded multiple hearsay. Okay, I get a witness who's an administrator who was told something by a teacher who was told something by a student. And that's what I get. Now, if in fact this is a miniature of the system you would find in downtown, that wouldn't float. Okay, now I know that in other administrative hearings, ones that I'm used to, that all three of us conduct, and in arbitration cases and so on, we're very casual about hearsay for a variety of reasons that I think are probably good reasons. But the question I think you need wrestle with is whether, given the seriousness of the consequences of some of these findings that are made in these cases, and the fact, is it appropriate for them to be based on multiple hearsay, particularly multiple hearsay that wasn't cross-examined because the other side wasn't there? I mean, you could just make up anything, and it would come up the system from the student to the teacher that's reported to the principal that testifies. And there's nobody in the room who can ask about whether, how do you know that? Unless it's us, okay? Which leaves us as the adversary of the superintendent in the room. So I think that if you're looking for a sort of jurisprudential analysis of what's going on here, is it a fair system by ordinary community standards? The real question is, do you really ever prove anything? When these kids get in this much trouble, is there really proof? Or is there a sort of, almost like a rumor, that reaches the hearing? Not because there's something perverse going on, or there's somebody isn't well-intended, because I think we all agree, everybody's well-intended. But we all know how that works. And that's something it seems to me that's worthy of worrying about. I worry about it in my hearings, because I know the people whose word I'm taking didn't witness the thing they're talking about, or even talk to somebody who witnessed it.
Thank you. Are there any others?
Mr.
Sanders?
Regarding what he said about some discretion on behalf of the examiners, I've had concerns about that in the past, but I see uniformity now, especially when Mr. Swadowski came on, and now that Joe is doing them, I see uniformity and consistency in my case. I make sure that that's done, and I assure that in my decision. Regarding the dates of expulsion, I've had some concern about that also, but when I question that. So generally, I have been satisfied that they look at the date that's more appropriate for the student, more convenient for the student getting back, take the exams and all of that. So I don't have as many concerns about that anymore. Now, regarding hearsay, that's a fundamental tenet of law, per se, and sort of different with Mr. Bellman. Some attorneys for the district, especially some of the previous private consultants, used to raise the issue that hearsay is allowable in these procedures. But hearsay is not allowable per se. You got precedent based upon DPI or the school law decision that says, to the effect, I'm going to paraphrase, when a school official does a credible investigation by contacting credible students or witnesses who give testimony, then they can relate it to the district. Attorneys will try to sneak that in, but those are the only circumstances that hearsay is allowed in these proceedings. When an official like the principal or dean or whoever conduct the investigation, contact witnesses that they consider credible, contact all relevant witnesses, write that up and present that as their case. So I don't have any problem with that, even though in our everyday lives as attorneys, hearsay is generally not allowed. But you got precedent based upon your case law, DPI, public instruction, and all of that. School law is a different beast. So they can search and do everything. I don't think it's fair to the student, but it's a fact of life.
Well, one thing is that I always make sure I do question and make sure that they've, when they talk about when somebody comes and presents for the district, the witness, I want to make sure that they have talked to all, you know, like when they, I want to really listen to what they say in terms of how they interviewed all the different parties involved and how they came to their conclusions as to what actually happened. So I absolutely make sure that that's something that comes in there. In terms of just consistency, I suspect that most of you know that, because I've certainly had a couple of cases, last year was at least one of them where I brought to your attention some things that I felt were just not right in terms of what was going on, in terms of, yes, there was something that happened, but that I felt that there was some very strong evidence that there were some things that were not being appropriately handled in the, at the school level, not because anyone was trying to do it, because clearly there wasn't. I mean, I felt it from every single person in the room that they felt that this was something that should not have gotten to the point where it had. And I think all of you know that, and I was very blunt about what I felt was wrong about it. You will not find me ever shrinking from doing that. I just feel that it's part of my job to make things as best as it is for everybody here. So, unlike Mr. Belmont, maybe it is also because I happen to be also a parent in the district. You know, because I feel like I'm wearing multiple hats within the whole situation, and I feel that it's absolutely necessary to do that. And so I am totally on, you know, you're going to hear from me when it is. And it's happened in the past, too. I've had a couple of cases where I felt that there was something wrong right fundamentally, and this board has heard it from me if there is something wrong. Just in the same way that I feel when they've handled it right, I think it should be brought out. When I feel that the district has done a good job and really has been thinking about what's the best interests of the students and everything, they should be said that. But if there's something wrong, I'm not afraid of saying it. And I'm not, I don't feel it's just as simple as did it happen or didn't it. There are factors that go into it. And that while I think it is something that you have to sort out, which is what I said in this last case, the one case that I'm thinking of, I want to make sure that you know it, because if I see it, clearly you would want to. I think you would want to know that, and so I'm very comfortable with that. So, and in that point, maybe it'd be very good for all of us to talk to each other, so we could see what we're doing across those lines. But those are how I handle those concerns that were brought up.
Thank you. Mr. Sanders.
If I may, while I'm thinking about it, I remember what I wanted to say earlier about some of the things not working. Also, when I was reading this list, it dawned on me that one concern I have is when the student and the parent are not represented and they show up, generally they don't say a thing, and I question why are they there. But it's because they are laypersons, but they need to be put on notice that if they don't contest or contradict the allegations, then they're going to be deemed omitted. You got to contradict, object. So it needs to be put perhaps in the notice of hearing that they're present at the hearing is so that they can defend themselves by presenting contravailing evidence, given your size of the fact. How I'm going to handle this is that I always advise the parties when they appear before me, tell them their rights, their appeal rights, even though Mr. Hill has told them. I also elaborate on that and give them some more. But I'm going to, from henceforth, advise the witness that this is their opportunity to do their due process, present their case. If they don't say anything, then the facts are going to be deemed as true, and that they need to say something if they have anything to say, and give their argument. In any event, they can argue regarding appropriate discipline, put forth factors that they think should lessen the recommendation of the district, if appropriate.
Thank you. Does the board have any follow-up questions? Ms. Cole?
I just wanted to follow up with one thing that you, Ms. Daniels, were talking about, and I'd like to ask the other two gentlemen, which is just clarification if there are any cases or if you could cite an example of where you have ruled against the district's recommendation. You know, it doesn't have to be a specific case, but has that ever occurred? How many times? What would have brought you to that point that you would have ruled against the recommendation?
In my case, it's a very small number indeed. I don't know how many cases I've had. I think I've been in the system since the beginning, but I don't know what the fraction that my caseload represents. There have been a case or two, I think, it seems to me, whether it's been a recommendation of an expulsion that I didn't agree with. I think it's there is a higher number of cases in which I felt that certain facts were not proved, and therefore the offense was different than the offense that was charged. But it wasn't that there was no offense at all. And because of the strictures of the rules, your rules, the result isn't much different. If there are three offenses charged and an expulsion follows, and two of them fall by the wayside, which isn't that unusual, and one of them is sustained, then you used to get the same outcome. So I would say the net effect of my cases has been the preponderance in favor of the superintendent's recommendations is huge in my cases. And, you know, there are probably a multitude of reasons for that.
Generally, my decision have been in line with the district recommendation, too, generally because, as I indicated, I think they're pretty uniform now and consistent. But there's been about three or four instances in which I have ruled against the district. One of them related to a pencil being used as a weapon, sticking another student. I rule that pencil wasn't defined as a weapon, but as used in this particular situation, it was used as a weapon. But I ruled that under the circumstances, the interest of the school did not demand that student expulsion. And that led into, I think, which is a decision that you all should be aware of, if you're not about the interest, whether or not the interest of the school demand a student expulsion. I assume that you are aware that if the examiner rules that the interest of the school does not demand a kid expulsion, then you're finished with that case? Okay, that came out of one of my decisions, and it was never clear until that point. And another case I ruled on, which posed some problem for me, was kids was in a fight. This particular kid got jumped by two or three other kids in the cafeteria, defending himself, and got recommended for expulsion. Along with that expulsion, they charged the kid with repeated refusal and neglect to obey the school rules. And the kid was a special ed. It was determined that that fight aspect of the facts was causal connection. I knocked out the whole case by saying he wouldn't have been charged with repeated refusal and neglect if he hadn't been in the fight. And since that was a causal connection, the whole case fell. So my point is that that was pure application of law. I think it was a great decision. They wouldn't expel that kid, but for the repeated refusal and neglect. I also have problems, and I don't think the system is working, with fighting. When a child get jumped, beat, or whatever, you expel that kid along with the same ramification as the kid that jumped on the kid. That's not fair. Anyone in this room, I would submit, if you attack, you're going to defend yourself. I haven't had one of those in a while, and when I will respond to it, but I don't think it's fair, and the system is not working when you expel a student who is defending himself or herself when they attack.
Do you want Ms. Daniels to respond to Ms. Cole's question first? Okay.
Would you extend that concern to cases where a student has been repeatedly bullied, not necessarily physically attacked, but repeatedly threatened, and does something because they feel they need to defend themselves?
Well, I think you have to look at a case-by-case basis, and I saw that in your list of potential questions, and that is a valid concern. As you know, it appears that throughout the United States, I think it was Finland more recently, that kids take the law into their own hands, commit multi-murders and all of that, and generally it's determined that the kids have been bullied. That's something that needs to be looked at real closely. What is the child to do when they're bullied and can't get any recourse? They go to the principal, teachers. That's not protecting the child. So I would look at that real closely. I think it's something the district should look at.
As you know, I had a case last year that did involve a student who had taken an action, and it was very clear including the testimony by the principal themselves, that this child had been bullied the whole year. And I just, it was an extremely difficult case for every single person in that room, because that child, we had failed that child. And I mean, just as, I don't mean it, as, but we just collectively, we failed that child. And I don't think it, based on anybody's problem, and we, it is definitely something that we need to look at. I think particularly at the middle school level, because I think the middle school level is where you see these cases in particular. The high schools are big enough that really students can learn to do it. But in that middle school level, with a much smaller schools and with students who are there together for a long period of time, it is extremely difficult for those students. And it was a it was just a case that I, you know, and I think it came out in everything that I wrote to you, that this was just one that I think that we, you need to look at the policies, absolutely, and that the schools need to be given a good, firm direction on what the way, what they can do to nip that in the bud, because it's the only way that those students are going to get.
May I just speak to this? To the extent that you begin to formulate a self-defense argument in favor of people who are in fights, self-defense of any sense, that I was jumped and therefore I was in the fight, I was bullied and therefore I was in the fight, what you are generating is a fact-driven process. It's good. We're really going to have to know exactly what happened. My own sense of things is that if you want examiners who are sort of like judges and not inquisitors, and you're going to have unrepresented people making these arguments, then you're going to have there's going to be an incongruity in the process. That is to say, the process is not equipped to come to subtle, nuanced findings about facts. It just isn't. You don't have equally represented people. You don't have equally articulate people. You don't have equally people with equal status, any of those things. And so I personally back away from arguments that are sort of heavily laden with factual findings. And that's why I said earlier, it's sort of a question of did it happen or didn't it. That has nothing to do, I mean, it's a separate point, it seems to me, as to whether bullying ought to be tolerated in the schools or whether bullying ought to be addressed by some educational policy or some other kind of administrative policy. But if you leave it to us to let kids get revenge when they're bullying, I think you're going to start something you're not going to know how to finish.
Well, and you notice that in the decision that I made, I did not say that the student should not be recommended for expulsion, because the student did what they did, and that needed to be dealt with. But what I did want to draw attention to was that you as a board needed to look at a policy that went beyond that. In terms of a couple other cases, just so you know, of things where I actually didn't recommend, just so you know, there was one more recent case where it was what may have been antisocial, gang-related charges, and I felt that, and this was interesting because it was the case where there was where I had multiple students in front of me. I certainly felt that the district had made in two of the three cases that I had. In one of the cases, I did not feel that the requisite information was there to expel the one student, and so one student I did not. I said that he should not be expelled. But the other students, that I certainly felt that they had made the case. So I think it was one student was caught up with a group of students that it really hadn't made their case. And see, that's where I felt that having all the students or a group of the students in front of me actually made it, I made a better overall set of decisions based on that. And then the only other one that I can remember very clearly was a case where but for a staff member making what I felt was an inappropriate decision on what to do about a student who had brought it wasn't a weapon, he had brought in a Leatherman tool to show off, and the teacher just said, oh, fine, but just put it away and let it go. nothing would have actually had happened. I don't know, this would have been quite a while ago. But that one, I felt that it was clearly, it was based solely on the fact that if the staff member had not made an inappropriate choice, the incident wouldn't have happened. And so I did not feel that my student, which wasn't even the student that had brought it in, I certainly did not feel that the student that I had in front of me should be expelled. And so those were the cases I had.
Thank you. And then we have one final question as we begin to wrap up. Do you have any general opinion or concern regarding whether students are adequately represented during expulsion hearings? And that basically comes back to the student advocate. If you believe a student advocate is necessary, does it need to be a legal person, someone that can just guide someone through the system? What are your thoughts on this? And we can start with Mr. Sanders.
I've had hearings involving several attorneys, and I don't think they did any good. One attorney did raise that legal issue about the interest of the school demand that the student be expelled or not, because we had to do some legal research on that, and we made clear in my research and in response to his legal arguments what the law was, so that was good. Have had, like I said, several attorneys. Again, I wonder why they are there. But yet, a student is better with an attorney, because most of the students that I mentioned earlier in passing, they don't understand that when they are talking and not contradicting the evidence, they dig themselves into a hole. They talk too much without an attorney, which is brought out by counsel. That's their job. But they would be best to keep their mouths closed. So an attorney doesn't do any good. Having an attorney is better than not. I have had advocates who were pretty good. They brought out pertinent issues relating to the child's character, record, how they're doing in the community, a good child, and all of this. Advocates tend to go on too long, like most laypersons do. So it's a mix. I would say, overall, attorney doesn't benefit a kid in these procedures because their rights are limited. The district going to put on their case. Generally, they can't identify the witnesses because the cases say the witnesses don't have to be identified because of threats and other things. So the student come in blind. That's one reason I say if they get the case documents at the beginning of the case before the hearing, they might know someone who can give testimony to their favor or contradict some of the other information. I don't know if that's an answer or not. Maybe it's lawyer lack, huh, Mr. Bell?
God forbid. I think you only have to ask yourself, how would you like to go into a hearing where there were important consequences that might befall you and the other side was represented and you're not? That's as simple as that to me. Some lawyers do good jobs and some lawyers don't. In some cases, need them more than others. But if there's a rule of thumb, it seems to me there ought to be some sort of playing field leveling at the policy level. And the notion that there's a policy that justifies one party being more well-equipped than the other seems to me a hard argument to make. This isn't the only place where that happens, but typically it's a function of the economics of the parties. Some party can afford it and the other one can't. And whether you want to address that or not, I guess, is a question of resources and other things. This isn't an isolated case, but it might be the case that in every forum where typically one party is represented than the other, every one of those instances, it's unfortunate that that's the case. And what I have found in my few cases where people have been represented is that although counsel's guilty of the excesses that Henry is suggesting, it is also the case that they look more closely at whether the district followed its own rules, which is something that as pupil and the pupil's parents are very unlikely to do. But in the preparation, the lawyer looks at what he's got. It may not be enough, as Henry is suggesting. But he looks at what he's got. He's got your rules, and he sees the hoops you're supposed to jump through before we get, or before somebody's supposed to jump through before you get to the hearing. And if the lawyer can identify a procedural deficit, they'll do that. And I think the rules you have are reasonable rules, and you ought to follow your own rules. And there ought to be some consequences when you don't follow your own rules. And the only time that's ever going to come to light, I would suggest, is when parties are represented, when the pupil is represented. So I think I understand the challenges of providing representation. And I certainly wouldn't be wanting to be heard to say any kind of representation, any representation is better than none. Okay, so I'm talking about good representation here. I think it's very difficult in the abstract to make a case for one party being represented and the other one not being represented.
Thank you. Ms. Daniels?
I think it's interesting because in both the situations where this one and in my regular job, very few people actually are represented, even in areas where we're talking people who have businesses that it's going to affect with them. And you would think that they would just get a lawyer, but a lot of times they don't. The sort of overall abstract justice issue doesn't really get to you to say, how do we deal with it in terms of cost, and how do you deal with it in terms of having people who are good at what they do? Because just having a representative doesn't mean you're going to have good representation. And this is a specialty area, and you've really got to understand the differences. And administrative law generally is a specialty area, and many lawyers are simply not equipped. When in my other job, it's the same kind of thing, where they don't really understand the administrative part. It's a very different kind of setting, and you really need to understand it in order to do it. Having said that, I do think that even though he cannot obviously represent the student, I do think that your district lawyer does an excellent job of trying to think about what's the ramifications for the students as well, and has been very good when he's had some concerns about a particular case and whether he can really make the case for it, that is not shy about really saying that this is what he's got and that's it. I mean, I don't think that he feels it's incumbent on him to ever expel a student that he's really felt that the case has not been made. I don't see that at all, and I think that's one thing that you have. But you're talking about putting that shoulder on one person's shoulders, and that's a lot to put on one person.
Mr. Carlsmith?
I have a couple questions with regard to this issue. This is an issue that we're looking at in the Student Senate, which is a student government organization. Clearly there are significant obstacles in attempting to allow the students representation in this process. I heard some implication in some of the comments that a particular skill level and experience level within a student's representation would be necessary for that representation to be beneficial in the case. Do you think that that's true? For example, you couldn't have just a law student or someone or an advocate, a community advocate, something like that. That wouldn't be beneficial for a student. Essentially, addressing any representation is not indeed better than none.
If you look at other settings like labor management setting, you will find undegreed union reps who are very, very good at presenting grievance arbitration cases and so on. I don't want to be sort of categorical about it. I'm sure there are a lot of accountants that could do tax litigation if they were allowed. People from counseling disciplines who could handle divorces. I mean, I think it's entirely possible that there are law students out there and there are non-attorneys who could be very effective advocates as a generic proposition. My point is, that if you undertake, if the district undertakes to provide that kind of representation, you've got to undertake to determine whether the people you're putting in those jobs actually have those skills. Not that they have something on paper, but that they actually have the skills, which might mean to train, might mean something about their training, might mean something about some sort of process that you engage to evaluate their work or something of that sort. It's certainly not beyond my imagination by any stretch to suggest that there aren't non-attorneys that could do this work. Or that there's some, that you have to be of a certain age or any other characteristic. I'm just saying that as you look across the broad population and you're picking out individuals to do it, you need to have a process in place that identifies the individuals who will do it well. Because otherwise, it's such a false representation to make to the person that's being represented.
Thank you. My other question is to Mr. Sanders.
This will be our last question as we're pushing our time limit.
Oh, I apologize. Do you believe that the dynamics of the of student representation would change should the student and the attorney be provided the documents and the evidence or whatever beforehand?
I feel strongly about that. Yeah, like I say, any attorney get involved in the case, first thing they do is request the documents. You want to see what the case is about, what they got, etc. I feel strongly that it would be, the student would be better served if they got the document in advance of the hearing, probably along with the notice of hearing, if that's practical.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. This was, I personally found this very helpful. What we're going to do is we'll continue with a series of meetings on the topic of expulsion. So at our next meeting, we're going to talk about some of the suggestions and points you made, and we'll be sure that as we make decisions based upon your feedback, that we will get back to you as we use these in looking at our process. So I appreciate all you do for us.
Would it be helpful to the board if we desired to write you a memo or a letter or something regarding that?
Oh, if you have any feedback on the questions that we submitted, sent to you in the letter or anything, please don't hesitate. You can send them to Mr. Hill, and he can get them to us.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Did you want to change? Did you want to change the agenda?
Yeah. Good. You want to move it out?
Yeah.
Just move to. Take item number 7 out of order.
Second.
We have a motion and a second, and that's basically to take item number 7 on our agenda and move it next on the agenda because we have some people in the audience that probably need to get home. So, Mr. Carl Smith, your advisory vote?
Aye.
Board, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That passes 7-0. Next on the agenda, then, is fees for and agreements for participation in inter-district high school girls cooperative hockey programs in 2007-08. Turn it to the superintendent.
Thank you. The purpose of this item on the agenda is to ask the board to approve the continuation of the girls cooperative hockey program based on commitments from, I believe we have 7 young ladies who are playing on 2 different teams. We have a team on the east side and a team on the west side, which is new this year. Both Mr. Malin and I have discussed this with the parents involved. We are very confident that there is no real financial danger to the school district at all, that they do, in fact, have sufficient funding to continue this. There are 2 separate motions that we prepared to ask you to act on, one for the team on each side of town. So,
Ms. Kubsa.
Just to clarify, so with the new or with this memo on how this would be handled, the girls' hockey program would still be paid 100% by the participants.
That's correct.
So you know, we've had a lot of discussion about boys hockey. It's still considerably different than that because this is paid 100%.
That's correct. We're subsidizing boys hockey. I mean, boys hockey now, about $485 a child. This requires no subsidy. That was the original agreement when the teams were formed.
Mr. Winston?
I'll make the motions. I move that the board approve entering a one-year agreement for intergovernmental cooperation for establishment of a cooperative high school girls hockey program for the 2007-2008 school year with the Sun Prairie Area School District serving as fiscal agent. Do I need to say all of this? Mr. Miles, can I stop right about there?
Can you
I
say
guess
that
not.
We'll get an official legal opinion.
This could be the longest motion we've ever
made.
I think the way that you could not read it all directly would be to make an express reference to the document and state it as the motion as written on the memo. And it will be the first motion with respect to the Sun Prairie School District. And then if your motion references the document, we kind of incorporate the document by reference. And if there's discussion on it, we'd have to deal with an amendment, and we'll deal with an amendment if and when that happens.
Okay.
The express version.
Okay. What I just said, as expressed in the document, in the paragraph one, first paragraph. Is that enough?
Second.
Should I say the memo? Mr. Winston, if you could identify the legal services memorandum and the date from me as stated in the board packet, I think that would be clear in the record, at least which document then you're referring to as opposed to saying nothing else about it.
Okay. I move legal services memorandum November 12, 2007. Regarding the board approving a one-year agreement for intergovernmental cooperation, as I said before.
The motion, second by Ms. Carstensen.
Yeah.
Any discussion? Mr. Carl Smith?
Aye.
Board, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That passes 7-0. Mr. Winston, one more time.
Again, legal services memorandum dated November 12, 2007. Move that the board approve entering a one-year agreement for intergovernmental cooperation, establishment of a cooperative high school girls hockey program for the 2007-2008 school year with the Middleton Cross Plains Area School District serving as fiscal agent, again, as stated in the memo for the second paragraph.
Second. Motion and a second by Ms. Mathiak. Any discussion? Mr. Carl Smith?
Aye.
Board, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Then that passes 7-0.
Could I just
speak one
moment, Mr.
Please.
Baird, just real quickly. I did have several conversations today with some of the parents who are involved in this program, and to me it seems like with Mr. Mylan's help as well as the superintendent, I think we were able to alleviate some of the stressors that were involved with students participating in this activity. Again, I think it's very important that our young people have access and opportunity to participate in programs that the district doesn't provide, and the parents that are involved in this program have worked very hard to make sure that their children can participate. And again, this is obviously legal formalities, but again, I want to say thank you to the parents who are involved in this program and also to the staff. And hopefully, in the future, obviously, you know, as we move forward with this, we can continue our cooperation and have good communication and continue these types of programs. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Winston. Next on the agenda, revisions to board policy 4045, expulsion. Superintendent.
Okay. Actually, as you recall, the last time we met on this, the board asked for some revision to the documents, and this is really to ask you to approve the documents as revised, and I'll be glad to ask Joseph to go through the revisions if you'd like to be reminded of what those were.
The packet that you received contained four documents. The first one that I'd like to talk about is just page 3 of the letter that we typically send out advising students and parents of the date, time, location, their rights, etc., concerning an expulsion hearing. At the top, the beginning paragraph is italicized, and that's the information that I told you that we would modify and incorporate into the document that you asked for at the last meeting. Are there any changes that you would like to see in that italicized information? Basically, it captures what you stated to us at the last meeting.
That's fine.
Okay. We will move forward then with incorporating this in all of our letters and having them translated into Hmong and to Spanish. And as soon as the translation process is finished, we will begin using the letters with this information included.
Do we need to vote on this?
I don't believe so. This is the next document that I'd like to speak about is just the fourth draft of the standard of review that we had talked about, which now reflects the changes that we discussed at the last meeting as well. You will find the information that was discussed as being added on concerning supplemental information is italicized and appears as 1C. And then at the bottom of the standard of review, just to make certain we were clear about what constitutes the record and what constitutes supplemental information, we would add that definitional note as well. This reflects what we discussed at the last meetings. Any comments or questions with regard to the standard of review document?
Ms. Cobza.
The legal memo from the Office of Legal Services. I know we went through that last time, and so we know what's going to be in that memo. But I do have a concern about putting in our policy that we're going to receive a legal memo, and you know, people in the public, the student wouldn't necessarily know what that's going to contain. And it could be much broader than what we actually do get. And I'm just worried that that gives the appearance that we're getting additional information outside of the record that really goes beyond what we were anticipating. So I'm just wondering whether that legal memo really does include anything that we would use beyond what we have in the record, and whether we should just strike that from C. Leave in the expulsion off-campus instruction form, but take out the legal memo.
Well, it's certainly going to be your prerogative which way you want to go with that, but my understanding was that you wanted the legal memo for the purposes that were identified in the new version that June had prepared at the last meeting. It also specifically limited the use of the information contained in the legal memo. It prohibited the use with regard to the issue of whether or not the student should be expelled, and limited the use to the question of the terms and conditions of the length of the expulsion and the early readmission. So it would have that caveat as being the limitation as to what you could use the legal memo for. If you feel as though now you don't want the legal memo, I have no problem in striking the legal memo from this. And what you have is just one piece of supplemental information that would be provided, which would be the off-campus instruction form. I think you probably would be best heard from June as to what the implications might be beyond my knowledge about the impact of that decision, though.
The legal memo, again, basically sets forth the legal background as to why students can be expelled, sets forth parts of our policy that specifically have to do with whether a student can be expelled, the things that happen with the student. So virtually all of the information is more or less summarizing what is in the record and giving you, as I said, the legal background as to why you can expel a student or and that we provide the off-campus services, which is not something that's required by law but is required by our policy, that type of information. I guess that technically it would not impact your decision. It might make it easier for you to focus in on the information. So I'm not sure if Ms. Cubza was saying she didn't want the legal memo or she just didn't want that included as part of the policy.
And maybe even if we change what we're calling this from legal memo to something about summary, yeah, case summary from the Office of Legal Services. What I'm concerned about is legal memo sounds like a brief, which so could be much more expansive than what it actually
define
is.
Define what it really is.
I think the information is important. It does make it easier.
Well, and if it, and it really is just a summary.
Would it be okay if we just change the name from legal memo to case summary and still let everything else remain the same?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, then let's do it that
yep.
way.
If I understand my colleague, the concern is that we don't want language that makes people think we're getting something that we're not.
And something that they're not
and that will disadvantage
entitled
people.
To yeah. provide, so that we get it from one party and not the other.
Actually, I believe I'm correct that in this case, whether this matters or not, June is acting as your attorney.
Right. It's the information that your attorney provides to you to say you can do this or you can't do this.
Okay.
Any other comments or questions with regard to the standard of review with that one modification, changing the word words legal memo to case summary?
Ms. Mathias.
Yes.
This is just a tiny little technical thing because we are in the process of searching for a new superintendent, and it has to do with the standard of review checklist. Could we say, did the superintendent deviate from his or her baseline recommendation?
Not a problem.
I thought we...
We're not on that yet. That's
oh, okay.
the next stop. She's undocumented ahead. Okay, moving on to the standard of review checklist document with the modification just articulated by Ms. Mathiak, are there any other comments or questions? The changes that were made are reflected in the last item under the delegated legal counsel review, italicized. Did the superintendent deviate from his or her baseline recommendation? Yes or no? If so, why? And the explanation will be inserted. The explanation would be the same information that would be contained in his explanation or her explanation in the affidavit recommending the disposition in the case. So, for example, you would see a student was involved in, let's say, a level 300 violation, but there was bodily injury and aggravating factor which permitted us to go forward with the expulsion. But because a student who was injured sustained a broken arm and a broken jaw, those facts were sufficiently egregious to cause the superintendent to think, I think I want to keep the student out an extra semester with regard to early readmission, so that student has to stay out two semesters before they can apply for early readmission as opposed to one semester, which is what the baseline would provide for.
In my notes from the last time we met, there was I had written down that Ms. Kubza had asked if the matrix should be reflected or tied into the standard of review checklist. Is that basically covered in the question on the baseline recommendation, or did you want something else? You didn't want any more than
well,
that?
Well, I would like it expanded a little bit, just because the baseline recommendation, this is what I'd like to suggest, and I apologize. But is the superintendent's recommendation the same as the baseline recommendation for the length of the expulsion and the conditions for readmittance under the specified grounds? So then it ties it into both that, the length and the...
Okay, that would be answered in where it says, if so, why, it would tell you both of those scenarios. If the superintendent's recommendation was for a lengthier period of expulsion.
Right. I understand that's the next thing. But I'd like to expand the first question just because I don't, his or her baseline recommendation doesn't seem to me to be clear. We're talking about really the district's baseline recommendations now, that we have that chart and that's what's going to be consistent with that chart. And if it's not, the superintendent's going to explain why in this slide.
Just including both length of the expulsion and time for early readmission.
Right.
If you'll tell me the exact words, I'll be glad to put them in.
There they come.
Any other changes to be made other than the one we just discussed? Then with that addition, will we be finished with this particular checklist then? Okay. The last document that I'd like to talk about, I'm going to...
I do one question. Since we're going to be getting the checklist in our packet, right?
Yes.
Do we need to refer to that as the supplemental information? Is that... an additional piece that we're getting?
No. This really is just a form that would be used as to guide the review process. It's not information that's being considered as to what you should or shouldn't do. The last, the last document I want to talk about, I'm going to call it Exhibit A, thanks to Mr. Winston. And I'll explain why in just a moment. It's the proposed revision to Board Policy 4045. And if you'll turn to the next to the last page, I want to talk briefly about Section 20. There's one insertion of a letter that I'd like to have made in the second line, minor, the pupil's parent or guardian, and provide. I want to insert the word A after provide. Provide a letter.
Exhibit A.
Exhibit A. Yeah. What you see here, I don't want to read to you all of it, so we'll circumvent that. What we're doing here in this document is basically advancing to you what the administration's position is, and that is we're hoping that you will do two things tonight. Adopt the standard of review as agreed upon tonight, and then secondarily incorporate it as part of Board Policy 4045. So what we had to do was to clean up that business about the supplemental information that was contained or is contained in the existing 4045-20 sub B. If you look at B, everything has been stricken. So that would be coming out. Now, the first portion of B, we still would be using, though, because really we were talking about the second part that was the problem. So we've moved the first portion of the stricken B and added that into the A. So you'll see they're pretty much identical. So that takes care of the problem of getting rid of the old 20 sub B. Any questions about what's on the next to the last page of Exhibit A? Then moving on to the last page of Exhibit A. The bottom portion of the page, my copy is in bright red. I doubt that yours is, but I want to start where it says Board of Education Standard of Review of Hearing Officer Decisions. And what you see is the standard of review that we've adopted tonight. I'll make the change on here that's consistent with what we said a moment ago about changing the word legal memo to case summaries or case summary. And that occurs in two places. It occurs in 1 sub C, second line, and the last line in the definitional note. This now reflects what we've talked about earlier tonight as being the standard of review that's acceptable to the board. So I would request that someone move, and hopefully the motion get passed, that Exhibit A be adopted as the standard of review of this Board of Education and be incorporated into the Board Policy 4045.
Would someone like to make that motion? Ms. Kubsa?
I move that the board adopt the amendments to Board Policy 4045, which is attached as Exhibit A to the November 7, 2007 memo from Mr. Rainwater to the board.
Second. Motion and a second. Is there any discussion?
With the amendments as discussed at this meeting.
Right. And incorporated as part of board policy?
And incorporated as part of board policy.
I was too quick on the second, but I still second it.
Goodness. Ms. Moss?
Now, earlier we heard from the hearing examiners who said that they thought it might be useful for the students to receive a copy of the exhibits before. Is this the right time to bring that up? Would this need to go in this policy?
No.
It would not. Okay.
I'll address that, but that's not. You don't need to address that in this policy.
Okay. I also think after our discussions, if there are additional amendments we want to make in the future to this policy, we certainly can. So it's just good to get Mr. Hill... have us be completed with this task that you've worked very hard on, both of you.
And I'll be glad to respond to any questions that you may have about what you heard from the hearing examiners, either tonight or another time.
I think in a separate meeting,
okay,
since we have other people waiting. Any further discussion?
They said you walk on water, Mr. Hill.
heard.
Did you hear that?
That was actually my question. Is it true that you walk on water?
I just swim well.
Mr. Carl Smith?
Aye.
Board, all those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? And that passes 7-0.
Thank you all. That's been excellent work. Thank you. Thank you, Joe.
You're welcome.
In June, and everybody that was involved.
Next on the agenda is school security activities, and we will take a 2-minute break while we're getting set up. 2 minutes. You cannot. We will get started. Back to our meeting. Next on the agenda is a presentation on school security activities, and I will turn it over to the superintendent.
Thank you, Ms. Silvera. Make a couple of comments before we start. First of all, as you can tell from the outline, this is a tremendous amount of information. So we recognize that it's very possible we won't get through this all tonight. So if y'all want to set some kind of time limit, and we'll stop and we'll come back and finish where we are. We're going to make some rearrangements. We're going to move item number two, which is relationships and engagement, to the very end, and we would do that last. So we'll start with legal issues and then move to what we're doing now in security, and then move to some recommendations or some ideas. Recommendations isn't the correct term. Some ideas that we have for how to improve our security. So let me start with, and if you want to watch the time, and at some point we can stop, and then we'll come back and continue from there if this gets too long. So let me start. One of the issues we have regularly is where we have jurisdiction to act and where we don't, and it's something that the vast majority of the public doesn't understand. So we've asked Luis and Dan to be here tonight to talk a little bit about jurisdiction and those kind of things for the school district. So, Dan.
Thank you. As Art said, you know, one of the I think, common questions or issues that comes up in a community as well, if a student commits a criminal act outside of the school context, is there anything that can be done at school? We also run into questions of what practically can we do in a response or as a response to security and safety concerns when we have a limited disciplinary jurisdiction, at least. And I want to emphasize the word disciplinary jurisdiction, because there are many ways that, as a school district, for example, if the goal is prevention of safety, we can seek relationships and engagement by students, maybe through an MSCR type program. MSCR has a lot to do with helping the engagement process, and yet in some ways MSCR is outside of our normal school day and school jurisdiction. But disciplinary jurisdiction, I'm referring primarily to suspension and expulsion, which are the primary tools that we have to address consequences for a student for serious acts that I think we're focused on in these presentations are fairly serious threats to school safety and school security. So within the statutes, we have a limitation that anything we do disciplinary-wise as far as suspension or expulsion needs to relate to conduct that occurs at school, conduct that occurs under the supervision of a school authority. So that would take care of events off school grounds under which school employees are still supervising the students. It's still a school-sponsored activity. And then finally, we have the ability to address in a disciplinary manner endangering the property and person of somebody who is at school or under the supervision of a school authority. And that would cover, for example, phoning in a threat. You do it from home. You're not at school. You're not under the supervision of a school authority at the moment. You're at home making a phone call, yet you threaten someone at school. Outside of that, and I guess also a disciplinary or consequential mode, you have the ability through the athletic code, because athletics are viewed as a privilege rather than part of the fundamental right to education. And we certainly do address through the athletic code some off-campus activity. And again, for purposes of tonight's discussion, where you're dealing with some, again, fairly serious threats to school security and safety, there's a question of, is an athletic code even an adequate venue to get at consequences? Because many times I think the students who are involved in athletics are engaged enough in school where they aren't the ones that are ultimately are threatening the students or the safety of the school. So there's a question of, is an athletic code even adequate, even though it gets to off-campus behavior? So with all that going on, we do that against a backdrop of events where a fight that occurs outside of the school day, off campus, creates spillover back into the schools, and we do that in a context where events at school create spillovers into the community, where we have again, a fight or disagreement among students that developed at school. Nothing happened at school, but before you know it, a few blocks away from school, we have an incident that spilled over. A question becomes, what can we do four blocks from school, a mile from school, known places where kids congregate after school, be at the mall? What can we do at bus stops and bus transfer points? And the question becomes, in large measure, one of our disciplinary jurisdiction. To the extent we want to go beyond our disciplinary jurisdiction and start supervising activities that are not at school or on school time, we run into questions that are not easy ones, and we'll get to some of the issues later in the question of what are we doing specifically to address safety about resources. To the extent we're even looking at anything that's outside the school day or off campus, we're taking eyes and ears off the school in a time of limited resources. We're looking at questions of potentially liability. If a staff member is out in the community, what limits do they have on their ability to act, even when we give them a directive, let's say, to supervise students or to go check on a situation? There very well may be limits that they have to adhere to from a liability standpoint and insurance standpoint when they're out there in the community. And then finally, there's a question of if a school employee is trying to do something outside of our disciplinary jurisdiction in a place that's outside of our jurisdiction or a time, what can they ultimately do? They can tell the students to stop. They could call relevant authorities who actually have the power to respond, but they can't tell them, I want to see you in the school office tomorrow because I want to talk about the consequences that I'm going to levy for this activity that I'm observing. We really don't have that authority. I do want to point out as an example of where we've had success, I think, is there's been a lot more planning surrounding specific security approaches to things like high school football games, not being done on a how do we provide for a secure environment at football games generally, but looking at the specific game, time, place, other factors that are being addressed from the school day. What do we know about activity among the students between the two school districts at that time, and setting a security plan that's very context specific. And so when we're doing things in our disciplinary jurisdiction, I think we're doing well. And so we have that backdrop of jurisdiction. And then there's a question of, well, if we don't necessarily have the power to literally react and respond to all things in all places that involve students, we have interactions with people who do have the power, law enforcement in particular. And in the legal backdrop to all of this, we have a great deal of interaction with our law enforcement, the Madison Police Department. And I want to focus briefly on two issues where board policy can make a tremendous difference in the ability of a school district to be successful in responding to issues dealing with safety and security. The two issues are, number one, sharing pupil records with law enforcement, and then secondly, school board policies that deal with how police can interact with students once they're in a school building, dealing with questioning students in response to either being called in or the police potentially being shown up in response to information they received. We call it questioning, or in some cases, interrogation of suspects if it is a student who is being or who is suspected of criminal or delinquent activity. And we have policies, very extensive ones, dealing both with the pupil records issues and with the interview and interrogation. I think the way that those policies work best is with a continuous dialogue with our Madison Police Department to say, what about our policy is creating problems for you, potentially, that is the Madison Police Department? And then the question becomes, what are your suggestions? And then as a board, how do we feel about those suggestions? Because there's a very broad continuum among school district policies in terms of how much access and at what times and under what criteria do we allow police into the school building to question students. The same is true on a pupil records front. And within the past few years, some relevant developments on pupil records is simply that we have broader ability to share information with law enforcement in a couple of specific circumstances. One is where the police can identify a threat to the health or safety of an individual. The pupil records laws at both the state and the federal level were amended to account for situations where getting information in a timely basis without the necessary, I guess, you know, written consent procedures will respond and potentially prevent a health or safety emergency with respect to anybody. It could be another student, it could be an employee, it could be someone out in the community. It's a fairly broad exemption, yet limited to, it really needs to be necessary at the time and place. It can't just be convenient. We also have the ability to share with law enforcement directory data. And in fact, we don't even have the ability. We have a mandate in the statute to share directory data, which basically consists of, for these purposes, student name, address, telephone listing. When the police are conducting an investigation into potentially criminal or delinquent conduct. We also have interesting, I think, developments in terms of issues like security camera use, and we're going to get into that as a security measure. There's a question right now dealing with how do we, once we have these security videos, what do we do with them? Can we share them with a parent who wants to use a security video to rebut an allegation or to see what their student did? To what extent are they pupil records or not? And there was some federal guidance that came down very recently on that that suggests to school districts that they consider specifically deeming security videos to be law enforcement unit records. And there's a distinction between law enforcement unit records, which would be records, in our case, primarily of Luis's office, potentially the EROs in the high schools, and our security staff, that are different from pupil records. And I think that is an avenue, while it's a fairly new concept, again, in board policy, you could address it. The point I want to largely leave you with on both the sharing pupil records with law enforcement and the ways in which we deal with police presence on campus and dealing with students is that there is that large continuum. It is very often worth addressing where we stand on the continuum in coordination with law enforcement to identify ways where we could improve clarity, legality, practicality, and filling any gaps. And as just one example of a gap, we have a lengthy procedure on the ways that police can question or talk to a student. But just the other day, we had a question of, can I serve a harassment injunction to a student at school? And there's nothing in board policy that says anything about serving an injunction. So we could fill a gap there. But that's just one example. But again, it really is your policies that are in play here on those issues. And can be relevant when we deal with our friends in the law enforcement area.
So are you recommending then that we take these policies and look at them to make them more relevant?
It's always an option. Just 2 years ago, there was a fairly substantive look at, I think it was the interrogation, and Carol could probably be the best memory of this, but Frank Crisafi mentioned that 2 years ago, the board did take a hard look at the policy that deals with questioning of students in schools, and at the time made some changes. And the question becomes always one of, are we facing new situations and new, I think, obstacles to providing a safe and secure environment that the policy perhaps didn't anticipate at the time, and again, I think law enforcement is instrumental in helping to identify the questions. You may hear the issues and say, all things considered, our policy was designed with some very particular protections for students in mind, and our judgment is that the suggestions for changes that have been brought to our attention as possibilities, we don't want to go down that road, and we're comfortable where things are because we haven't quite figured out how the suggested changes would meaningfully prevent the next incident from happening or respond to it better. But again, it's always worth asking the question because we're seeing new situations develop.
Ms. Carstensen?
Yeah, for those who weren't on the board, the focus of the board's concern was that students have access to their parents before they are interrogated by the police, and there was a lot of concern about making sure that the students' rights were protected effectively. And obviously, there's a tension here on practically everything Dan talked about of how do we, you know, where do we draw the line between the individual student rights and what are perceived as security needs.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ready to move to the next one?
Yep. I'd like the principal to present on stage then, please.
That was very helpful.
Thank you, Dan.
Superintendent, one quick question for Mr. Mallon. Are you going to be recommending or bringing some things back to the board? Is that what I heard in terms of your conversation or your discussion?
Well, I guess the question is one of if we hear something, for example, on this notion of dealing with security videos as law enforcement unit records that wasn't ever brought to anyone's attention, I think that is something that I would be likely to forward to you and through an administrative team to vet a little bit to think about the consequences of that, because there can be consequences. It may be a good idea, it might not be, but it's a new idea and a different way to do it. So there are certainly some things, yeah, and I think with respect to some other changes, part of me says, unless, again, I hear that something is creating a direct obstacle to providing a safe and secure environment, for me to live with the policy for a little bit so that I understand it, and as relatively new legal counsel here, understand the ramifications of any suggestions before we dive into major changes.
Yeah. Thank you.